Oyez, oyez, oyez. All persons having business before the Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the United States and His Honorable Court. Be seated, please. Case number 09-1011 et al. Coalition of Battery Recyclers Association Petitioner versus Environmental Protection Agency. Mr. Wigmore for petitioner, Coalition of Battery Recyclers Association. Mr. Lane for petitioner, the Doe Run Resources Corporation. And Mr. Hostetler for the respondent.
Good morning, Counsel. Good
morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, I'm Michael Wigmore. I'm appearing on behalf of the Coalition of Battery Recyclers Association. This case involves a challenge to final national ambient air quality standards for lead promulgated by EPA. The petitioners here bring five separate challenges. I will be arguing with respect to the first three of those challenges and have been allocated 12 minutes of time. I request that 3 minutes be allotted for rebuttal. Mr. Lane will argue the final two issues, and he has been allotted 8 minutes of time and requests that 1 minute be allocated for rebuttal. The first issue that I'd like to address is petitioner's contention that EPA, in setting the final level of the NAAQS standard, had to account for the fact that the averaging period that EPA's methodology uses results in an averaging period of a year. And EPA recognized this when it was undertaking its risk assessment approach, but in the final evidence-based framework approach, EPA claimed that such an adjustment was unnecessary. And I brought a demonstrative exhibit which essentially just lays out what EPA's evidence-based approach is. And basically, the lead standard that EPA calculates
uses... Can I ask you, is this in your brief or in the record? I can't read what's on the chart.
Yes, ma'am. It's in our our reply brief on page 4.
That chart?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, Your Honor. And so, basically, all EPA does is take... it calculates an air-to-blood ratio. It separately calculates what's referred to as a concentration response slope, which is the relationship between lead in blood and IQ decrement, and it picks a target IQ point loss, which the agency here set at no higher than 2 IQ points, and we'll address that issue in a second. But as you can see from EPA's evidence-based framework approach, all the units cancel out. And so based on EPA's approach, whatever the units are for the air lead averages is necessarily the units for the lead standard. And if those units do not correlate, the agency has to convert one to the other, just like you're converting miles per hour to kilometers per hour, and as EPA did in its risk assessment. Now, EPA argues that this
correlation... I don't understand the importance of that.
The importance, Your Honor...
I understand the words that you just said, but I'm not sure why that would make you win this case.
The importance is, Your Honor, that the EPA admits that the four elements of the standards have to be considered collectively, and that's at Joint Appendix page 81. You have to look at all four elements of the standard to determine how stringent it is, and EPA further admits that if you have a shorter averaging period, that reflects a more stringent standard. If you have to meet the standard on a daily or monthly basis, it's more stringent than having to meet it on an annual basis.
Yeah, that's all fine. I understand all of that. That said, how are you any closer to winning the lawsuit than you were before you said it?
Because Whitman says that you have to, Whitman, the ATA, the Supreme Court says that requisite to protect public health means no more stringent and no less stringent than necessary. And if EPA...
I'm with you so far.
Okay, and so because the averaging time affects the stringency of the standard, which EPA admits, that's a Joint Appendix 177, if you have a lower averaging period, it's a more stringent standard, which could run afoul of the Whitman...
Well, maybe it could. But the thing that I'm not getting from your chart, from your argument, and frankly from your brief, is much indication that it did. I mean, it's rather obvious that some standards are more stringent than other standards. Bang, sure. It's also true that Whitman said you have to do as stringent as you need to, but not any more stringent. Therefore, it's possible to err on either side. That's the sort of thing that agencies have to do all the time, and just establishing the possibility of error. That was there all the time. It was always possible they could have been too stringent or not stringent enough.
But the agency has to provide a rational basis in the rule for why it set the standard at the level it did in order to address the risk that it claimed to be addressing, which is...
That's probably where you should have started this argument. Now, what is it that's wrong with their explanation?
Well, by EPA calculated, its methodology calculates a standard based on what we purport to be annual average air lead levels. EPA claims that that's not the case, but the record reflects otherwise. At least
I'm still at a so what on that. The average is still going to be a point, right?
It's going to be average over
an annual average or a 3-month rolling average,
even
a shorter average. It would still be a point result.
But it's averaged over a time period. For instance, if the standard was the standard is 0.15 annual average, for example, you could have 6 months of being at 0.3, provided that you had 6 months significantly below the average and still meet the annual average. Whereas if it was a rolling 3-month average, if you have 6 months at 0.3, you necessarily exceed the standard for not only all those 6 months.
So that you have a standard. The standard can be exceeded, and then you're in trouble. That we knew that before you got here. We knew that before you wrote your brief. But I don't see how that comes to the point of establishing that EPA is unreasonable in the standard they set. You could say that about any standard they set.
Because EPA claims, what we're saying is that EPA did not adequately respond to our argument that some correction factor was necessary. Now, we couldn't provide the correction factors we did in our comments on the risk assessment because EPA didn't introduce the rolling 3-month average until the final rule
the evidence that shows that the impact is so immediate, this 1 to 3 months, and that's where the key damage is done, and therefore... that's the relevant period.
And we don't dispute that.
I understand that, but you want an adjustment that would relax the standard for that critical period.
We want the adjustment because EPA's methodology necessarily results in an annual
average. Isn't that correct?
That's correct. We do want the adjustment.
That's right. So EPA has all this evidence that says the key critical time here is this 1 to 3 month period.
That's right.
And so that's what they're focusing on.
But, for instance, if EPA's methodology...
And as I understand your brief, you don't dispute that there is an impact on IQ levels.
We don't dispute that there is an impact at IQ levels, and you could have an adverse impact on a short time period. But, for instance, if EPA's methodology, instead of using annual, if that average was a weekly average and EPA failed to correlate it, then the standard would be less stringent.
The failure to correlate is what you're not really explaining. What correlation is it you want here? Because you're making an apples to oranges comparison when you use that miles per hour against kilometers per hour. That's not the kind of thing that's going on here. This would be like miles per hour averaged over a 100-mile trip against miles per hour averaged every 10 miles during the trip. It's still the same units. There's no lack of correlation. They're still using the same units here. They're just averaged them over a different time frame.
The averaging that the agency does over an annual time period is part and parcel of the standard. There are four elements of the standard, and you have to consider them together, as EPA admits, in order to determine whether the standard is requisite.
Again? Where was that again? You're talking about the
EPA, the fact that there must be considered.
You gave a JA reference.
Yes, it's JA, page 81, column 3. EPA, the four elements of the standard must be considered collectively. And that EPA also admits that a rolling 3-month average is more stringent than an annual or a quarterly average.
I don't know why that's an admission.
They admit it in their brief.
It's simply a statement of fact that it's a more stringent.
They haven't provided.
I don't see how. You seem to have a non sequitur. It doesn't.
Well, because they haven't provided if, for example, EPA provided rationale on the record that,
what about
yes,
the
it's more
explanation that Judge Rogers just pointed out to you, which you admitted was true, that there can be a short-term effect, effect from even a short-term exposure.
But
why isn't that a rational explanation for using a shorter interval of averaging?
Because it relates simply to whether there's an adverse effect. It doesn't relate to how the agency's methodology calculates the average. I'd like to move on.
What do you say when the EPA says that many of the studies don't actually have a temporal period at all?
Well, we have two responses. Number one, two of the studies, as we pointed out, the HILT study and the World Health Organization study, it's clear that they use an annual average. Because
the ones that they say don't.
There's three. They rely on five studies. There's two that do. And EPA says it doesn't know what the temporal period is for the other three standards.
That's not a problem. So unlike the picture you have there, you should erase the words annual, because we actually don't know whether that's true.
That's true. We purport that they're annual, and we know from the record that at least two of them are annual.
That's no reason to believe that the other three are. So then the question is really the one that Judge Rogers raises, and which they give as their bottom-line explanation, which is long as you can show that there is that effect from the lead in the air within that amount of time, then it's reasonable to make that the time. Your argument depends on the word annual actually being correctly in the place on the chart.
Well, we put that in there, as we explained in our brief, because there are two that are annual and three of the EPA claims that they don't know what the averaging time
period is. You say claims. That sounds like you think they're lying.
No, I don't think they're lying. I think they really don't know. But if we know that it's not rolling 3 months, because nobody ever talked about rolling 3 months until the final rule. So whatever those other three averaging periods are, you know, they could be annual, they could be short-term, as EPA admits, but they don't, it's not rolling 3 months, and as EPA...
Well, then the question is, what was it reasonable to pick rolling 3 months? And that's the question Judge Rogers was really asking you, which is they have an explanation for why they picked it. It's not the explanation that you want, because your analysis depends on the studies all having been annual, and then the word annual canceling out as you go through units. But if they weren't actually all based on annual, then they have to have another explanation.
And they have another explanation. But the other explanation, as we point out, is not responsive to the units that the methodology EPA uses calculates. It's just simply an issue of whether or not there may be adverse effects at the short term, and we don't dispute that.
Well, if you don't dispute that, then how can you make the argument that they haven't given a rationale for using a short interval of average?
Because their methodology does not calculate it based on rolling 3 months or any other shorter time period. The best that we know is that there are two that are based on annual, and three that EPA says the record doesn't reflect what the averaging time period is. I'd like to address my other two arguments also, please, Your Honors.
You're about out of time.
I understand, Your Honor. In response to the questions, I ask your indulgence to allow me just to briefly address the final two issues.
We'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal unless my colleagues have questions. Are there any questions for this?
I'll give you a chance to answer the
case. You can respond to questions.
The Kasich question. Your argument that Kasich doesn't support the 1 to 2.
Right. And as we point out in the record, EPA points to Kasich as support.
Sorry,
for the...
I pronounced it wrong.
I'm sorry?
I pronounced it wrong. I didn't know it was Kasich.
Oh, sorry, it's Kasich, yeah. The EPA points to, in the final rule, EPA justifies the 1 to 2 IQ target as being supported by Kasich, where, in fact, if you look at what Kasich's response to that argument, Kasich says that statement is erroneously attributed as being Kasich's recommendation
wanted something even stricter.
They did want something even stricter, Your Honor.
So that goes the opposite of your argument.
Well, but again, EPA has an obligation to provide in the record a basis.
Well, I don't understand why that. The page that you're referring to is JA1151, right? You want to get the appendix?
Yes, Your Honor.
So the sentence that you read is reads, the error-related IQ loss framework proposes a target mean IQ decrement of roughly 1 or 2 points in the population as a level of damage that the proposed standard is intended to protect against. This target level has been erroneously attributed as being the Kasich's recommendation, right? That's the point.
That's right.
And then the very next paragraph, the first sentence says, Kasich wishes to emphasize that this comment refers to 1 to 2 IQ points as being highly significant loss to be prevented, not as a desired national damage level. Kasich wants something even lower than 1 to 2. And then they say this analysis would point to a range of proposed standards between 0.05 and 0.2 micrograms, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah. And in fact, the actual standard is 0.15. So it's completely supported by the Kasich statement.
But it's not what EPA has effectively done. If they just, is they haven't provided a basis for one or two, they simply split the baby. CASAC said it should be more. It should be less than one.
Well, you don't want it to be less, do you?
No, we don't. Okay. No, we argue that it's within the error rate of the test.
Their sole evidence is it shouldn't be any lower. It should actually be lower than 1 to 2, and they pick 1 to 2, and you don't want it any lower. This is to your benefit what they did. I don't understand what you're up to.
You want us to send it back and tell them to make it lower?
CASAC is criticizing EPA's approach and using this as a target endpoint. We said all along. But
they're criticizing it from the point of view as it should be lower. I could understand if you were the, I don't know, Sierra Club or something,
right,
coming in here and saying, this is outrageous. CASAC didn't suggest 1 to 2. They wanted lower than 1 to 2. But that's you're coming from the other direction.
But what we're saying, Your Honor, is that EPA hasn't provided any basis in the record for its target endpoint. It says, all it says, frankly, is it picked a target of 2. The CASAC says that's wrong because it's too low. We are arguing that it's wrong because it's within the error rate of the test, and it's been rejected by the EU and the World Health Organization.
That is not.
And it's not sufficient.
That argument is not in CASAC's letter.
That's true. The CASAC's argument is that that EPA didn't adequately support the 2 IQ point endpoint because it's too high, and frankly, they're taking out of context what EPA's what CASAC said. Our argument is that EU and the World Health Organization have rejected this approach, and also that it's within the error rate of an individual test. And for that reason, all EPA, the best the agency can say is, well, we've kind of split the baby,
argument
but that's
on
not adequate for
error rate on the individual test, which is the third point, I assume, of your argument you've now gotten.
The third point I wanted to address was whether or not EPA had to obtain the Lanphier study data, which is the.
Well, the one I did want to ask you about is the other one. So their argument is that is. Scope of deviation for an individual test.
That's right.
That theirs is an average, national average.
It's a population, that's right.
Right. And that those are completely different animals.
Yeah, but what we're saying is that it can't be, our argument is that EPA hasn't adequately supported selecting that as an endpoint, and we point out the fact, as the EU did, that EPA's target endpoint is simply within the error rate of the test and therefore can never be...
Not within the error rate of an individual
right,
test.
Right, which means that any benefits could never be assessed at an individual level. EPA just doesn't
they're
know.
Not evaluating it at an individual level. They're evaluating the effect of lead on the population. That's their argument. Do you have any idea what the standard deviation is for the average for the population as a whole?
No, that's not in the record, Your Honor, I don't believe. But the other thing is that, as we point out, this is just one of the many factors that we point to that the record doesn't support, too. We also point out that based on EPA's methodology, there should have been a corresponding increase, a dramatic increase in children's reading scores or IQs since the 1970s when lead was beginning to be removed from the environment, and that's not reflected anywhere in the record either. So, EPA tries to argue that those tests are restandardized, but they were in fact restandardized when the lead levels in the atmosphere were at their highest levels.
At this point, that argument would be an argument for the agency rather than us, would it not? We can't go back and say what you just said, that there should have been a rise in IQ points since the 1970s or 1950s, whichever point is taken. They've had all that data. They've weighed it, and they've come to the conclusion they came to here. Your level of detail is not something we're likely to speak to.
No, I understand that, John. I'm not asking you to select among different.
That's why we have an APA standard of review rather than the trial de novo up here.
I understand, John. But what we're saying, I'm not asking you to do that. What we're saying is that based on all this information, EPA didn't adequately. That's our argument. Our argument is that there's a lack of an adequate explanation in the record, and for that reason, it's arbitrary and capricious. And Judge Garland, if I could, I would like to address the whether or not EPA has to either release the data from the Lanphier study.
Well, they don't have it, do they?
You'll have to address the judge and tell he's the boss.
I'm sorry.
Well, they don't have it because the study authors have for 2 years. EPA admits that the grant pursuant to which the study was conducted and EPA's regulations require that it be released. And EPA has been trying to get it for 2 years.
Why is this not governed by American Trucking Association?
Because the argument of American Trucking Association was that EPA does not, the rule there that the court said is the agency doesn't have to release all the data for all underlying studies. That's not what, and further, ATA is distinguishable because the court there said that there was no argument that the petitioners couldn't obtain the data, and there was also no argument that it was improperly peer-reviewed or published. In this case, we're not asking for all the data. EPA claims to have reviewed 6,000 studies.
They relied on a study, among others. I think they used this with three others, did they not?
For the concentration response slope, but what they also say that this is the most compelling evidence.
They have the results of the study. They did not conduct
the study. They have the results of the study.
They did not conduct the study.
That's right.
So this is parallel factually, at least, to American Trucking Association.
Well, I don't think so, because, first of all, it's EPA, where EPA tries to minimize the argument by saying there's alleged errors. This is a situation where the published results were demonstrably wrong. Not alleged wrong. They're wrong. And we pointed that out to the agency. The agency conceded that the published results are wrong. And then the agency went back.
A case where we have ever ordered an agency to go get the underlying data from the study they relied upon rather than one where they possess it? I mean, releasing what you possess, that's even for you. You could get that if you didn't have a case. But as far as going to get data that you don't have, do we have an APA review where we've ordered that?
I know there are cases, there are cases that have overturned agency decisions for failure
to the question I asked.
Well, there's two. There's the American Radio Relay League because it didn't provide the underlying data, and also
No, but that case involved the data in the study itself. Remember, they redacted parts of the study.
That's right.
Yeah.
But that's
not going to the underlying data that the chief judge is questioning you about.
Where they've relied on a final study. And a petitioner or complainant has come in and said, go get the data from this other entity that did the study and give it to us. Do you have any case where we've ordered them to do that, them or any other agency to do that?
No, I think the closest one where, I mean, it hasn't come up much, but, I mean, there's also not a case.
Maybe a reason why it hasn't.
Well, there's also not a case where you can, as opposed to ATA, you have a situation where the data, the results of the study on which EPA relied, which it referred to as the most compelling support for adverse effects of low blood lead levels and this superlinear response, where the data was demonstrably wrong. Normally, when you go through...
Part of EPA's response is that where these errors were identified, they contacted the author of the part of that study, and corrections were made.
Well, they purport, first of all, as you can see, what happens is, and I want the obvious error is that this is all in the record.
I would say, if you're planning to come back here someday, we can't read that from here.
No, I understand. It's in the record.
Talking about that chart and putting it up on the beginning. We can't read it from here.
Okay.
If you're going to use an exhibit, if you insist on doing that,
it's got to be big.
You want to be.
It's in the joint appendix. It's joint appendix, page 391. And the reason I brought it is because
our attention called to that a lot quicker and less trouble to you.
If you see the next one, the reason is that it doesn't reproduce in the joint appendix, but part of it is actually highlighted, where you actually see the errors. So, for example.
Now we can see the part that we can't see.
Right. You can see the third column, and that's a joint appendix 959, but the color didn't come out in the joint appendix. But what EPA, Judge Rogers, responding to your point, these results are all from a pooled analysis. It's the same study. It's a pooled analysis of data. And what we pointed out was that one of the results that the study's authors reached was demonstrably wrong. And so it was sent back to the study authors. EPA admitted it was wrong. The study authors had to concede that it was wrong.
And they corrected that.
They corrected that error and sent back a new table. The second table, it was also wrong. Again, not allegedly wrong, demonstrably wrong. And so they sent it back a third time. So after three chances, the best that EPA can say is that this study result is not demonstrably wrong. The part of the study that EPA is relying upon is derived from the exact same data set of the two that we can demonstrate are demonstrably wrong.
Are there any other questions from my colleagues? If not, then we'll hear from the other petitioner. Thank you.
Thank you.
morning, Your Honor. I've reserved 1 minute of my time. The issue that we bring here is that the EPA violated the requisite standard in the Clean Air Act by setting the level at a number that is more stringent than necessary to protect the public health. EPA defined the public health risk here, or the public health goal here, as to prevent a population-wide IQ loss of 2 points for all young children. But instead of analyzing the data on a population-wide basis, it selected a subset of the data, which it says has higher blood level than the general population. So what that means is that when you're analyzing that, you're going to need more protection because of the higher blood levels. So as a result, by using the subset to do the analysis, they came out with a result that is actually going to provide greater protection than is necessary to realize the 2 IQ loss point reduction that they want. Now, the other factor that they took into account in analyzing this, is, as you've heard, is the concentration or CR studies. And
does your first point have to do with the nonlinearity?
The first point, when you just no, it doesn't. Well,
was this an attack on,
indirectly,
on the choice of the studies that show linearity below 10?
The second, this is the point I'm coming to right now with the CR studies. Well,
what's
Carl,
the first one based on?
The first point is that if you're going to do a population-wide analysis, you should look at children with the blood levels of the entire population.
And they looked at children who were in these exposed areas.
Exactly, Judge Rogers. And there's a higher level, so they're at greater risk. The point is the subset representative of the population? Because the subset...
Is it not appropriate to protect children at higher risk under the Clean Air Act? I thought that the Clean Air Act permits protection of sensitive populations.
The answer is it does if that's the population that you have designated to target, but the population that was designated to be targeted here was all children, all young children. So they could have said, yes, we're going to target just subset, and that's our analysis. And that's the goal that we're going to have. But their goal was a population-wide goal of 2 points. So by taking a smaller subset at greater risk, they were providing more protection than was necessary for the entire population.
What would be the alternative to that? Letting the high-risk population be even more at risk than it is? Or?
This is the problem, Chief Judge Santella. If you're going to do an average, you're always going to have people that are less protected and some people that are more protected. So,
wasn't that the gist of Judge Garland's question then? Aren't they entitled to protect the high risk against the high risk?
And my answer was, if they had designated that we only are seeking to protect the high-risk people, and that was their goal, yes, they could have done that. But what they said is...
So what they would have done then would have been exactly what they did anyway, right?
Yes, exactly what they did. But since their goal was to a lesser risk, they didn't... My point is, because the goal was to lesser risk children as well, they were more stringent. And part of the Clean Air Act is that you cannot be more stringent than necessary. So yes, they could by saying that they wanted to protect the entire population, they were including lesser risk children as well as higher risk. And so what they should have done was set the goal that covered all those children and nothing more, not just the high-risk children. I want to...
What's the best joint appendix site for your proposition?
That they are the high risk, it's 183.
Yeah.
It's the third column, Judge Rogers. It's toward the bottom of the page, in the third column.
Right.
Do you have it, or do you want me to read it?
Yes, I do. No, okay. I'm just reading it, so I understand what you're saying. I mean, it says including the at-risk population. That's, you know, I'm thinking about all these rules where EPA talks about the pregnant women who are more vulnerable, disabled who are more vulnerable. They're always talking about these sensitive populations. That they focused on children who were in areas where their exposure rate is likely to be higher.
Right.
And given the evidence that it's that first exposure that's so devastating to IQ development, I'm just trying to understand, as the Chief Judge asked you, what would the administrator have done here?
Mm-hmm. Well, my answer is yes. But if you, I keep coming back to the point that the sensitive population as defined by EPA is all young children, not this subset. And
would you like to explain how we would write the opinion that says that EPA erred in trying to protect at-risk children from damage to their IQ development?
Because they didn't say that that's what they wanted to do.
No, they
didn't. They only wanted to protect all children.
They wanted to protect all children with a 2.
Well, when you try to protect all children, isn't part of that protecting sensitive children?
Certainly it is, but the point is, under the statute, you cannot have a level of protection that is more requisite than necessary. So if you're...
In order to protect all children,
yes,
some of whom are sensitive, this is the level that's necessary.
No, I wouldn't agree with that.
No, you wouldn't agree with it, but the question is what Supreme Court opinion says otherwise.
But I think Whitman says that it cannot be higher or lower than necessary.
Yes, but it says you can protect a sensitive population, a vulnerable population, and that's what they're doing.
Well,
see, what EPA says, though, here in the same column that you cited me to, it says a focus on children with appreciably higher blood level, lead levels, could not be expected to identify a slope estimate that would be reasonably representative for today's population of children.
Right. But what they also say there is, I'm sorry, they don't say it there, but if you turn to page 181, Your Honor, and this is my concern, in the third column at the very bottom of the page, so that 183 was an answer to your question about the subset. Now, this is an answer to the question, did they have greater protection? And if you look at the bottom of the page, it's really the last four or five lines there. And they say the subset provides, we know we're providing greater protection to the population at large. Mm-hmm. And that's the concern under Judge Garland. The way that I read Whitman is you can't be higher or lower. And if you have greater protection, in my view, that is more stringent than necessary for the sensitive population, which EPA defined, not me, as all young children.
In American Lung, we said that EPA could protect sensitive sensitive populations, right?
Exactly.
So let's say we totally agreed with you. Gee, this is terrible. They didn't say children who live near, they only said all children. So we remand for the purpose of you substituting the words children near. That's your new purpose. And if you say that, we'll affirm you. Would you have an argument then?
I don't know what the numbers would come out with.
Well, what you're saying is these numbers come out this way because they focus on the children who live near the smelters, right?
Yes.
Okay. Are these numbers okay with you? Do you have a different argument about
those? We have a different argument about the numbers, which haven't
gone. You do, but not this argument. The argument you're making now depends totally on them using what you say are the wrong words in describing the population. So if they simply substituted sensitive children for all children, this argument would go away?
If they changed the population, then yes, I wouldn't have the argument. But the argument that the way that they define the sensitive population was all young children, not a subset of children.
You keep saying that, but EPA acknowledges in this very column you've cited me to that they are focusing on this subset.
And that's my point, Judge Rogers.
I don't see the language that says we're not focusing on the subset, we're focusing on all children. That's what I'm looking for.
Okay.
EPA says, you know, it's important to recognize that the error-related IQ loss framework provides for estimate for the mean
right.
of a subset of the population. I mean, they've acknowledged this. This is what they're focusing on in this.
And that's my point. But they say that
I thought your point was EPA says we want to protect all children.
Exactly.
All right, but in fact, they're only focusing on a subset.
It's slightly different than that.
Okay.
From Judge Rogers. What EPA said is our goal is to prevent a population-wide of all young children loss of 2 IQ points. So that is their goal. Their goal is on a population-wide basis. But by limiting the analysis to a subset of children that are at higher risk, no doubt, I'm not saying that that won't protect all children. What I'm saying is it provides more protection than they are allowed by the statute when they've said it's the...
I don't understand. I mean, I thought that was Judge Garland's question to you. EPA says, of course, we want to protect all children from having this 1 to 2 point IQ loss. But we're focusing, says EPA, on this subset that has this greater exposure, given all this evidence about the devastating impact of low exposure.
Judge Rogers,
yeah.
All I can say is that in the zone of reasonableness, you have a high point and a low point. We can say the more stringent and the less stringent point. Here, the idea in the zone of reasonableness test in the cases is that you have to take both sides of the zone into consideration, not just one side. So you can't say, oh, great, because we took a subset of the higher at-risk people, we're providing greater protection than necessary. But that doesn't take into account the other side of the zone of reasonableness, which is set out in the statute, that you can't be more stringent than necessary.
That's the necessary part that's the problem,
that's
right?
It, yeah.
The last column on 181 makes EPA's position crystal clear.
Yeah.
It says that it's important to recognize that the error-related IQ loss framework provides estimates for the mean of a subset of the populations, an estimate for a subset of children that are assumed to be exposed. The framework, in effect, focuses on the sensitive subpopulation, that is, the group of children living near the sources and more likely to be exposed. And then in the next, further down it says, As a result, EPA expects that a standard based on consideration of this framework would provide the same or greater protection for the remainder of the population.
Right.
So I just don't understand.
Place,
if EPA establishes, assume this so we can isolate this argument from the rest, that if they don't do this, children living near smelters will lose 2 IQ points.
Yes.
Your position is they can't do that because children in many miles away from smelters would only lose 1 IQ point or would not lose any?
The answer is yes, Judge Garland.
Right, tell me which case says that, because that's not what American Lung says.
No, it's not.
Here is my answer to that, and I believe that this is why it fits into the case law. If you assume...
Oh, no, I really want to know where in a case it says that the EPA cannot protect a vulnerable population by setting a standard that protects that population and therefore even a better protection for the remainder of the population. Where does it say that?
I think that's in the statutory language.
I don't understand why they couldn't if you hypothesized a world in which nobody but the children living near smelters had any risk, by your view, they would have to average that with all the zeros around the world, come up with a standard. They couldn't protect the only people who needed protection to the degree they needed it, because it wouldn't be necessary for other people? Is that your argument?
That's essentially exactly right.
Okay, that's your argument. Okay.
Because what they said was it's a mathematical argument. You look through their numbers. What they're saying is we've got to come to a 2 IQ loss. So, yes, when you take it on a population.
Even if there were no risk at all to anybody except the children living near the smelters, they couldn't have a high enough standard to protect those children living near the smelters to get them to the degree of protection which they deemed appropriate because other people didn't need it. That's your definition of necessity, of necessary under this law.
If the population, the sensitive population, is all children, and you're going to do in a mathematical analysis which averages across all children, I know you're looking at me skeptically, but when you do it,
I think you're saying they didn't do a mathematical analysis that went across all children. You're saying they went to the children that needed it most. Is that not what your argument is?
Yes, but the result would be then that is a too high.
It's more protection than other people need, but that may be necessary in EPA's view in order to protect the only people who need it or the people who need it most.
They should have named a different sensitive subpopulation then.
So we're back to saying we should send it back just so they could use two different words?
Your Honor, all I can do is argue against what they wrote, what I would have liked they had written.
Okay. Do my colleagues have any further questions?
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Lane. I do feel a bit odd seeing you at that table.
Thank you, Your Honor. It was not my decision to leave.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Eric Hostetler for the Environmental Protection Agency. With me at counsel's table is David Orlin from EPA's Office of General Counsel.
You want to clear up this last point we've been talking about?
I think you quoted from the applicable discussion at page 181 of the Joint Appendix, where I think EPA explained what it was doing in elaborate detail and quite adequately, that it was endeavoring within the context of the evidence-based framework to protect the sensitive population of children who actually will be exposed to lead at the level of the standard because they live near a lead smelter. There's nothing in the Clean Air Act that prohibits EPA from protecting the population of children who actually will be exposed at the level of a standard. Indeed,
I thought what Mr. Lane was arguing is that somewhere EPA had said, no, our goal is to protect all children. And the two pages he cited us to in particular, EPA says, that's not what we're doing. We're focusing on the sensitive population. So I didn't see where the agency had set a goal different than what its preamble identifies.
I was perplexed by what portion of the preamble discussion Mr. Lane was referring to, because I think it's quite clear that EPA was specifically endeavoring to protect the sensitive population of young children who will be exposed to the level of the standard. I don't think there's any ambiguity in that discussion. The standards are properly set to protect public safety, public health with an adequate margin of safety, and in particular the standards are requisite to protect young children from intelligence losses that may arise from exposure to air-related lead.
Can you answer Mr. Wigmore's point about the studies based on annual and how that gets recalibrated?
Absolutely, Your Honor. At bottom, Petitioner Battery Recyclers is mischaracterizing the record. The basic problem with the equation that they had in their demonstrative is the word annual. That word doesn't reflect the actual record before EPA. What that word assumes is that in its air-to-blood studies, EPA made some kind of finding that children need to be exposed to lead over the temporal period of 1 year to incur a particular air-to-blood ratio.
No, he says that at least in, I think he said two of the studies were of annual exposure.
That's also a mischaracterization of the record. The two things he's referring to, the HILT study and the World Health Organization guidelines, appeared for the first time in his reply brief, so we haven't had a chance to comment on those.
Reply brief before us? You mean a reply brief here?
Yes, yes. In other words,
they didn't make that argument below? That is, they didn't make the argument to the agency?
They did make the argument to the agency generally that they thought the studies related only to annual exposure. But with respect to those two studies specifically, the HILT study actually, you know, which is just one of a number of air-to-blood studies, did not purport to examine the temporal amount of time a child needs to be exposed to lead for a particular air-to-blood ratio to apply. To the extent there was any annual average concentration data in that study, it wasn't used for the purpose of calculating an air-to-blood ratio. And I can go into more detail if you'd like on that. But
you have a site. Is it in the joint appendix?
The study itself is in the joint appendix, but to explain how an air-to-blood ratio is calculated, you know, that discussion is not for a layperson to read the study and figure out how that calculation.
Looking at me like I'm a layperson. Where'd you get that idea? Oh, you're quite right. You're quite right. Well, I'm asking a simpler question, which is, if I look someplace in a joint appendix in the either the HILT or the WHO study, am I going to see the words annual? Am I going to be able to figure out why it does or does not support their position?
I tell you what you won't find. You won't find anything that says a child needs to be exposed to this particular concentration of lead for a temporal period of a year for this particular blood lead response to be valid.
Well, I understand that, but I think what his argument is, whether they need to or not, the studies themselves were conducted over a year, or they were using some kind of annual basis. Is that correct or not correct?
It is correct that there is annual average concentration data reported within the study, but it's not used for the purpose of calculating the air-to-blood ratio. It's kind of like, you know, you could find the number 6 in that study, but that doesn't mean that, you know, that's why there's a 1-6 air-to-blood ratio.
A layman can figure that out.
I mean, generally speaking, when you're calculating an air-to-blood ratio, you're in that particular study, it involved children living near a lead smelter in British Columbia, and generally they were looking at the relationship between air lead concentrations and blood lead concentrations before emission technologies improvements went on at the smelter, and then looking at the relationship between air lead concentrations and blood lead concentrations after smelter technology improvements. And when you look at those two relationships, you can do a mathematical equation to derive the ratio. But the fact that you used an annual average concentration to summarize the general air lead level at one point in time doesn't mean you were making any kind of finding about the temporal amount of time it takes for an air lead concentration to provoke a particular blood lead response. Now, because those studies, those air-to-blood studies that were useful in getting information on the air-to-blood ratio, didn't contain useful information on how much exposure time results in adverse health effects, that's why EPA looked to a separate set of studies, other evidence in the record to set the 3-month averaging time. And I think the court in its questions pointed to that evidence previously, and that petitioner Battery Recyclers has conceded that within a period of weeks to months, elevated air lead concentrations can result in elevated blood lead concentrations and IQ losses. So there's no challenge to the 3-month averaging time per se. The only argument is that somehow it's not correlated with this 0.15 level, but that's just simply incorrect. It's based on misstatements of what the record actually contains. There are a couple other things on this averaging time issue that I think should be noted. First of all, their entire position that somehow 0.15 and a 3-month averaging time is overprotective is belied by CASAC's recommendations. CASAC unanimously recommended that EPA set a numerical level no higher than 0.20. With their requested adjustments, the numerical level would go significantly beyond 0.20, so there's no support for that in CASAC's recommendations. Note also, CASAC, in addition to suggesting EPA consider a rolling 3-month average, indicated EPA should consider a 1-month averaging time. If EPA had selected a one-month averaging time, that also would have been reasonable, would have been also consistent with CASAC's recommendations within the zone of reasonableness. The standard would have been more stringent. Similarly, CASAC suggested EPA consider in its evidence-based framework a higher air-to-blood ratio than EPA focused on. They suggested EPA consider a 1 to 9 or 1 to 10 air-to-blood ratio. If that had been applied, it also would have been consistent with CASAC's recommendations and might have resulted in a more stringent numerical standard, all of which is to say this standard is well within the zone of reasonableness. And
is there another case on the way where some other petitioners are attacking the standard for being not stringent enough?
No, Your Honor, thankfully.
I was sort of expecting to see it next term or something.
Somehow I recollect in a brief answer to the question that they posed, which is why didn't, or is it true that that levels didn't go down, that IQ didn't go up as amount of lead went down?
All right. That precise question is addressed in a footnote in our merits brief. Obviously, there's going to be a lot of things affecting population-wide IQ levels beyond lead exposure. So you've got a lot of other variables.
Maybe you shouldn't have used the resultant IQ level as the test at all, but that's not answering the question that Judge Garland is asking you. Is it true that there was not a change in IQ levels over the period of time of decrease of lead in the air?
No, that's the point addressed in our footnote. IQ
levels. Where is your footnote? Now, let me suggest to all attorneys in this audience that if you want us to read things, put them up where our eyes are, not down in the footnotes. Our former colleague Abner Mick wrote a whole law review article on how lawyers hide their arguments and therefore the courts don't get them.
I think it's page 27.
Yes, it's on page 27 and it's footnote 9. And I apologize for putting that in a footnote.
It's all right, I saw it, but I couldn't exactly remember it. Thank you. Okay.
I did want to comment briefly on the Lanphier study issue raised by Batters.
IQ scores have increased by an average of 3 points per decade in the United States, right?
Right.
So you're saying they're simply wrong in their underpinning of that argument?
Yes.
Okay.
With respect to the Lanphier study, I think, Your Honor, as you noted, American Trucking does address this precise issue. EPA can rely on the results of a published study without having obtained and docketed the raw data that the scientific investigators who authored the study utilized.
And it's an agency call as to whether or not the errors are sufficiently serious that it would call into question the legitimacy of the study, or is your argument that where there were errors, they were either corrected or they weren't relevant to parts of the study on which EPA was relying?
Well, here, first of all, the errors in Table 4 were completely immaterial to the evidence-based framework and its application. So that's one thing. Second, the errors were corrected, and a corrected table was put in the docket prior to the public comment period. Third, it is a matter of EPA discretion as to how much weight to give to a particular study. And here, what we're saying, it was not at all arbitrary and capricious for the agency to rely on this study, especially in view of the fact that, as it happens, the raw data underlying the Lanphier study was subsequently reexamined in another published study, the Rothenberg study, and that study reaffirmed central conclusions of the Lanphier study, which gave EPA a lot more confidence in the study. In addition, note that CASAC specifically pointed to the concentration response slope EPA utilized in the Lanphier study and suggested that EPA give that slope weight. So you have the Independent Scientific Review Committee specifically advising EPA to give weight to this study, notwithstanding the immaterial errors in Table 4 that were corrected. Briefly, I think it is important to bear in mind the applicable standard of review. Obviously, this court is especially deferential to agency policy judgments where they rest on an evaluation of complex scientific data within an agency's expertise.
That's because we're lay people.
Moreover, in reviewing a numerical standard as counsel for Doe Run noted, the test is whether it's within a zone of reasonableness. There's no single correct numerical standard in a case such as this. It's also worth noting the statute does direct EPA to set a protective health standard, notwithstanding imperfect data, and to set a standard with an adequate margin of safety. I think that clause, adequate margin of safety clause, implies that to the extent there are scientific uncertainties, it is appropriate for the agency to act conservatively and to set standard that will be assuredly health protective in view of those uncertainties. I believe the remaining technical arguments they've raised are adequately addressed in the briefs, so I'm prepared to waive my remaining time unless there are further questions.
Unless my colleagues have further questions, then we'll take your argument as submitted. And
just 10 seconds to wind up. There's abundant.
Just to deny the petition for review?
Absolutely, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Now, each of the petitioners had used their entire time. We'll give them each back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd just like to address a couple of the points that Mr. Hostetler made. First, in response to Judge Garland's question, the HILT study utilized what EPA termed the IEUBK model. That's at Joint Appendix 370.
I thought that they didn't rely on that model.
That was in the risk assessment. Uh-huh. They used it, but what we're pointing out is that the HILT study, which they did rely on the evidence-based framework, also used the IEUBK model. The reason that the EPA claims that they had to correlate the risk assessment is because it used the IEUBK model, and that's at Joint Appendix 1164. Further, the WHO study at Joint Appendix 385 is clearly annual. It's an annual standard. With respect to the IQ issue that Mr. Hostetler addressed in response to the Chief Judge's question. First of all, the one IQ test has been restandardized twice, as EPA points out. EPA omits, however, that it was also restandardized in 1974 when lead levels were at their highest. So when lead levels are high, the test gets restandardized. When lead levels go down, the test gets restandardized. And further, the petitioners point
Counsel,
to a study.
With the fact that you may not think that's an entirely accurate test, but it is. It does give data that is inconsistent with your argument that there's been no change in IQ level with a change in lead level.
Well, no, what we're saying is that that's among the confounding factors. And frankly, we cited instead to a CDC study, which doesn't address IQ, it addresses reading scores, another measure of intelligence. And the head of the CDC lead poisoning office noted that there has been no corresponding increase in reading scores, another measure of intelligence.
Is that a problem with our schools or a problem with lead?
Yeah.
Well, I think that's the point of you. That's the problem with using IQ as an endpoint. You don't know.
It may be a problem with using IQ as an endpoint, but given that it has been used, your argument that there's been no change in IQ over 30 years is not a conceded point. There does seem to be data at least suggesting that there has been a change. And it is in that footnote.
And you're right, that it has gone up. It's gone up as lead levels gone down. IQ has gone up as lead levels when lead levels are high. It doesn't really show anything, because what's happened is since the 1940s, it's been restandardized.
Well, the most you have is that the data is undependable.
That's right.
So you're left with a zero argument on that. And
well, what we're saying is EPA is left with a zero argument, because what they point to for support doesn't support their position. And then finally, with respect to the land fear issue, I just want to make clear, it's not immaterial. As we've shown, if EPA does not, if you take out the land fear study from EPA's database, the standard can go up by 11%.
I thought their point was that the errors in the land fear were immaterial to the arguments.
Well, EPA assumes that the errors are immaterial. Because on those columns in the table, the land fear table 4, we've shown that the underlying data, which was used to calculate all the columns, there are errors in 2 columns. EPA doesn't know whether there's errors in the 3rd column or not. The best they can say is there are no obvious errors, and it's relying that beta in that column is the concentration response slope. That's what EPA is using from the land fear study, and it doesn't know whether there's any errors in that. The Clean Air Act requires the agency to accurately reflect the latest scientific knowledge, and the best the agency can do is say there's no obvious errors. And this is a point where ATA says there's not a general requirement to provide the underlying data from all studies. If the court accepts EPA's arguments in the response to comments that the agency only, it's within their discretion, would only consider turning over underlying data in cases of fraud, abuse, or misconduct, I mean, it's essentially saying the EPA never has to disclose underlying data.
Right now, that is the law, yes. They don't have to disclose data that they don't have, the underlying data. You're not posing a hypothetical. Before you parade horribles, make sure that they're horribles, because that's been the law up till now. You told me yourself we've never had a case where we've made any agency go get underlying data on a published study that they've used and release that data.
As we pointed out,
it's not an if. That is where we are.
Well, there's also hasn't been a case where a study that's gone through peer review, we've been able to demonstrate twice that there are demonstrable errors in it.
It's difficult to prove that negative, but it's pretty easy to prove the negative that we've never ordered an agency to do what you're asking for here. Really asking the court to step out in some pretty unexplored territory if we're going to start requiring agencies to acquire underlying data on published studies and then give it to petitioners.
Well, first of all, the EPA's own regulations require the agency to obtain this and make it available. But what we're saying is,
what regulation require, is that?
That they acquire underlying data and make it available.
EPA's, there's, because the landfill.
No, give us a site to somewhere
okay,
that it
it's
says.
It's 40 CFR section 30.36 D1. And that was the basis upon which EPA concluded that the data for this study has to be
made.
Give
me that site again.
40 CFR, section 30.36, D as in Delta, 1.
Do you have that in your brief or the JA?
It's not in the brief for the JA. It's in a, it's not.
You even cited in your brief?
We did not cite it in the brief because at the time the agency was attempting to obtain the data, and we argued that it had to obtain it, but EPA, in the middle of the public comment period, reversed course and determined that this data, initially the agency said the data did not have to be disclosed.
How about your brief to us? I mean, they were through with all that by the time you briefed to us. Did your brief to us cite that CFR citation?
No, it does not. One
of your central claims was that they didn't give you this data. You're now telling me that their regulations required them to get this data and make it public. And you have a CFR citation that says that and you didn't cite it? That's pretty hard to follow, counsel.
The agency, frankly, what happened was the agency reversed its course.
Petition after they reversed this course?
No, the petition was actually what happened, Your Honor. What we cited to is the case decision that addresses this issue.
Same point?
Yes, sir. Yes, Your Honor. So that we didn't cite specifically point cite to this reg, but there's an ongoing case where EPA conceded that this data has to be made available. In fact, I don't think that it can be contested.
This is in your brief, you said.
Yes, Your Honor.
And what's the site, just so I'm clear?
The poll site is on, Judge Santel, you're going to love this, but it's in a footnote on page 24 of our primary brief, footnote 11. And EPA does not contest this in their reply. And in fact, counsel for EPA is the same counsel in this related case where EPA has conceded that this data has to be made available. It's not,
FOIA.
EPA, there's a FOIA request with the agency, and the agency concluded that it has to provide this data because its regulations, by providing funding for the study, and that is that's referenced in the Landfear study that it's funded by an EPA grant. And EPA's regulations, based on the site that I just gave you, says that EPA has to disclose this data. Now, we raise this, Chief Judge, in our principal brief, but EPA doesn't even contest it. That's why we didn't bother. I mean, it's not a matter of dispute. The agency concedes that this data has to be made public.
I thought their whole argument up till now had been they didn't have to obtain that data and make it public. And you're saying they concede it?
EPA's argument is that the agency, in the context of a rulemaking, that ATA stands for the proposition that it never has to obtain underlying data unless it's in its discretion, and that's the test. You know, regardless of whether it's industry, environmental NGOs, any member of the public, the agency can rely on tests that are published with errors without providing underlying data. That's EPA's position of its obligations in the context of a rulemaking. But this other case that EPA is involved in is a FOIA case. And in the context of that case, EPA has conceded that this particular study, because it was funded in part by EPA, is subject to FOIA and has to be made available. And we raise it because the ATA argument, you know, the case, the ATA decision,
but you
was
are
a
telling
qualified
me now,
decision.
I can't get it up on West on the laptop right now, but you're telling me now there is a regulation.
That's
that
right.
Says they have to obtain the underlying data from studies they rely on and release it.
Where they fund it.
Where they fund it. It's referred to as a Shelby Amendment request, where basically Congress required that if
you're saying they erred in this case by not obtaining it and disclosing it to you. You say there is such a regulation, and you didn't cite that CFR regulation anywhere in your brief, including this footnote that cites it. It doesn't exactly cite a case. It says there's been a complaint to which they have acceded.
That's right.
In a FOIA situation.
But EPA didn't.
Which doesn't really seem to have a heck of a lot to do with the issue. But you have a CFR that you say is directly on point.
EPA.
And you didn't say it.
EPA conceded.
See, your rebuttal argument, an oral argument, we've never heard of this CFR.
Well, Chief Judge, if EPA contested that was not the case, we certainly would have addressed it in our
counsel,
reply.
Counsel, it's been one of the hottest issues in the case has been whether they had to turn that data over or not. You can't say they didn't contest it. And you're saying that. Finally, at oral argument, at rebuttal, you come up for the first time with a CFR that requires this?
Wouldn't you find
that surprising if you were me?
No, honestly, I don't, because the argument in this case is whether or not EPA can ever be either required to obtain underlying data or determine that it cannot rely on a published study because there are so many errors evident in the published study. The related case is a FOIA case, and EPA doesn't contest. I mean, we put it in our principal brief. EPA never contested that it has to make this study available. Had they done it, we would have cited this regulation that makes it clear that they do have to do it. But they don't even contest it, so there was no reason for us to address it in our reply.
Aren't there really two different arguments here? So one is whether they have the data or could get it.
Right.
But the other one is whether it's all right for an agency to rely on the results of studies rather than having, in every case, to review the underlying studies, even if they fund them, right?
I agree.
Those are separate questions.
You stated it much more clearly than I did in response to Chief.
Well, it's because I'm a layman. And this latter question, which is whether it's reasonable for them to rely on third-party studies, as a general matter, ATA certainly stands for the proposition that it is, right? Regardless
that's
of whether...
Gentleman. That's right.
So the question is whether the kinds of errors you've pointed out here,
that's right,
which they suggest are immaterial, which you suggest are material, are the kinds of errors that should so put the study in question that they shouldn't have relied on it.
That's right. I mean,
right? That's the question.
Yeah, there's something rotten in the state of Denmark.
Well, that's the question of whether there's something rotten in the state of Denmark.
Well, fact that what we believe is that we've demonstrated on two different occasions there are demonstrable.
I understand that, but that is a separate issue from whether or not they could get access to
it. I agree. Okay. But the reason I brought it up is because in ATA, in the ATA decision, the court says that petitioners have not made a claim that they were unable to.
That was one reason why ATA didn't require the production.
That's right.
But that doesn't say that's the only reason.
No, but one of the other reasons is said there's no claim that it was improperly peer-reviewed or published. Right. And we pointed out that even after, you know, this purported peer review, it's published with demonstrably evident
And what do you
errors.
Say about the Rothenberg study re-reviewing and reconfirming the study?
The Rothenberg study generally reconfirms the Lanphier study's superlinearity conclusion, but EPA still refers to Lanphier as the most compelling evidence. And as we said,
I understand you have another peer-reviewed study that itself again approves the previous study,
but
and that's not good
the
enough?
The slopes are different. That's why the Lanphier study comes out with by far the highest slope. It's an outlier. And if you take that slope out of EPA's evidence-based framework, that's where we make the argument that if you just by removing the Lanphier slope, the EPA admits that the CR slope drops. Now, our EPA argues that it's immaterial because it wouldn't change the standard by much. But even if what we point out is even if you accept EPA's methodology, forget about the annual adjustment, and do everything that EPA says they're going to do, you can the standard can go up by 11% and still fall below the 2 IQ point threshold that EPA set as a health, as a safety standard. So it's an 11% change. This is by far the most stringent standard in the world. And 11% may be immaterial to EPA. It is not immaterial to the folks that have to comply with this standard. It's a very significant change.
I want to ask you one more question about 30.36D. That by its terms applies only in the FOIA context, doesn't it?
Yes, that's right. Right. It relates to FOIA. And that's what I think Judge Garland clarified.
In response to a Freedom of Information Act FOIA request for research data. So that has nothing to do with this case since it's not a FOIA case, right?
I think as Judge Garland tried to clarify, it is two different issues, but what EPA here has, in the context of a FOIA case, has admitted that...
It's admitted that in the context of a FOIA case, it has to comply with a regulation that applies to FOIA cases.
Right. And the study authors have refused to comply with that regulation.
Is that in our
record evidence that something's rotten in Denmark.
Is that in our record anywhere? That's another case. We don't have any record on it. You didn't make a FOIA request, did you?
There are several FOIA requests, but okay. we are not in that lawsuit.
That's not before us in any event.
That's right.
You're citing a regulation that doesn't apply to this case, right? Maybe that's why you didn't cite the regulation any sooner. But
no, it relates to the issue of whether or not EPA.
It may relate to the issue, but it doesn't govern EPA.
That's certainly true. It does not govern. The statement that EPA
Thank
makes.
Thank you, Counselor. We've taken you about 13 minutes beyond the 2 minutes of rebuttal I allotted to you.
I appreciate
you.
It.
We will hear
Thank
from
you
Mr. Lane. Thank you.
Your Honor, I just want to make one.
I knew you looked familiar. Now I understand
yes,
from
now,
Judge
Sattel yes.
why.
Been a long time, but thank you. I just want to bring up a citation to where EPA said the sensitive population was all young children. That's at JA 76. It's in the third column. It's at the top of the page. That was the one question you hadn't asked
yep.
Judge Rogers. And unless there are any other questions,
Hold
I will
on,
not go on
will,
for 13
because,
minutes.
You know, after that, they are very clear what they're doing.
Well, actually, that just says young children continue to be recognized as a key sensitive population, right? Not the key sensitive population. A.
Well, that, right. I guess you're right, Your Honor.
Us reading
right?
is a language.
That you're right. You could name any key subpopulation you want. What I'm saying is that with
it
all that.
It recognizes the sensitivity of the elderly, and that may be a particular concern to some of us lay people.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Lane. Case is submitted.